Hello, welcome to Unofficial Partner, the sports business podcast. I'm Richard Gillis. Today's guest is Angus Buchanan, the managing director and co-founder of the Sports Consultancy, one of the leading independent consultants in the sport and entertainment sector. And they occupy a space between the rights holders and host cities, a relationship that's under great strain as COVID-19 shutdown tears up the sporting calendar. What happens next is the theme of this conversation, and Angus is in a good spot to shed light on that question. The host cities contribute billions to the sports economy, but get far less media coverage than the other major investors, such as media and sponsors. Angus's team have been able to map out the emerging international and domestic calendar for over 40 sports. This gives them an insight into the decisions that need to be made on both sides of the host rights holder divide. And so we ask the question, is there a better way of organising the sports calendar, and who is going to do it? Angus, one of the questions I've got when I look at the plans that are being made and publicised around the sports calendar is, I'm just thinking, the end of 2020 going into 2021 is either going to be the greatest sort of year to 18 months of sport ever, or an absolute shitfest of chaos and politics and legal disputes and all the rest of it. So I want to just talk about what the reality is. We can all see the challenges, but I'm just wondering what this crisis has that revealed about how sport works and the international sort of coordination between sports and governing bodies, even within sports. So what you work at, well, we should talk about where you work. Where what's the sports consultancy sort of position in the landscape?
Yeah, okay, well, that's a good place to start. I can give myself a plug. We'll get back to your question on having had a massive drought, which I think is probably an understatement, whether we're going to have an enormous flood, overwhelming flood of sports events, and probably that is the case. But to give some context in terms of where we work, there are three things we do. We're a management consultancy. We're a commercial agency to the extent that we sell certain specific types of rights, one of which is pretty common or garden to the extent that everyone's very familiar with it, which is sponsorship. And we do a lot of sponsorship rights sales, but we specialize in hosting rights. And we're one of the very few, we think possibly only agencies which specializes in the sale of those rights, i.e. the right to host a major sports event, brokering that relationship between major event and government. And the third thing we do, which is a little bit functional, but we used to do it just as an aside to our transactional work, is legal. And we started doing that as an adjunct. We now have a law firm attached to the business. So to your point around conflict and a glut of sports events, I think probably the answer is there are going to be both of those. And we're beginning to see on the law firm side a really significant uptick as we start talking about those horrible concepts like force majeure and cancellation. So we can hopefully provide a bit of context across the piece. In terms of who we work for, we work for some of the world's larger sports events, rights holders, international federations, national federations, and private sports events. And we work for government. We do a lot of work for government on consultancy and helping them broke the rights to host major events, and then when they've won those rights, we're assuming we help them win those rights, how they then make the most of them, so how they fulfill on their objectives through the hosting of events. And our client base is pretty senior, so we work at a relatively high level within those organizations, normally at, you know, with those decision makers in each of those organizations. So we are very, very lucky as an organization to be party to some of the thinking that's going on around the rescheduling of events in this really, really strange and unprecedented time. And that, I think, gives us some privileged access. So I have to be a little bit cagey in what I say through the course of this discussion, and you understand why. But otherwise, we are also observers of this virus and the implications that it's having for the industry, as everybody else is. We're watching this strange period unfold from a management perspective whilst we're not watching any actual sport. And the curious thing is that I think all of these organisations who are responsible for organising sports events are probably as busy as they've ever been, but probably all for the wrong reasons, which is just coping with the outcome of this crisis.
Right. So there's a couple of things that just pop out of that. So you've got, there's an uptick in legal, and from someone who didn't know what force majeure was, and now, you know, I've talked about it several times. I'm still very sketchy, but I don't really want to get into the detail
Let's
of it.
Not.
But your suggestion is that, because there was a sort of period where everyone was being nice to everyone else, and it was, are we getting to a point where actually things are changing? There's a tonal difference in the relationships between rights holders. Is that why there's an uptick in the legal side?
Yeah, I think so. I think, yeah, put bluntly, it's because the implications of this from a commercial, not just a commercial perspective. I mean, we're looking at the sort of the, even down to the cultural change which will happen as a result of this crisis. But first and foremost, everyone is concerned about preserving income or economic benefit. If you're working for a host city, you're concerned about making sure that if you're paying for something, as indeed is the case with a sponsor or a broadcaster, if you're paying for it, you want your product. So the commercial implications are the first and foremost considerations at this stage. And I think everyone recognises, and hence the discussions around force majeure, when neither party can deliver on their obligations, and it's nobody's fault really, because there's this horrible virus which is out of everybody's control. Who should still be responsible and for what? Or does that, in effect, mean that neither party should be held to its obligations because it was outside the control of both? God, I'm sounding like a lawyer. I don't mean to, but you can see how those discussions go. And you know, for many of these events and the agencies and the supply chain that works off these events, this is really profound stuff. This is a complete stoppage of income unless these events go ahead. So the first consideration is, well, frankly, if you're Wimbledon or you're Major League Baseball and you're the prescience and presence of mind to get pandemic into your insurance provisions, then you can probably realistically pass the loss on to the insurance company because you're going to get all of that money back through the insurer. For almost everybody else, you've got a choice between cancellation and loss of income, or, and this is the most common reaction at the moment, is how, you know, can we postpone this within the season, voted commas, and ensure that we still deliver the event and can take our income. It might be less income because we might not be able to gate it, so there might not be any ticket receipt, but can we still hold on to that income from broadcasters and sponsors by continuing to have the event through the course of the year? And that works to a degree, and I think everyone is sympathetic with everybody else in this situation because, again, this is something completely outside everybody's control. But I think we are starting to get to the point where postponements, whilst the natural reaction, aren't always realistic, and there will come a point where it becomes clear to everybody that they can't just postpone. There's going to be a cancellation, and then everybody's going to be holding their hand out for their money back.
So you've got a couple of sort of directions. If I'm sitting here and I'm in charge of a big event owning rights holder who is desperate for my event to go forward, I can either go into negotiation with lots of other places and try and find a weekend or a week or a fortnight over the next year where I think I can get my event away. Or I can just say, no, sod that. I'm just going to get my elbows out and go in, and this is where we are, and we're going to do it here, and then argue about it later. Is that the sort of spectrum of the decisions?
I think that's right. I think we have to bear in mind that seasonality plays an important role and always has done in sport. So, you know, if you're Wimbledon, coming back to Wimbledon, as we read in the press, there are only so many weeks when you can have grass court tennis. It's just very limited in terms of the English summer season as to when you can have that. So even if they hadn't had, as they did have, cancellation insurance for pandemic specifically, there's only it's a very tight window when they could have had that event anyway. So postponement would not have been realistic. Both the players and the courts and the nature of the calendar would have meant that they would not have been able to postpone meaningfully. So it's just as well they had the cancellation insurance, and good for them. For others, seasonality is slightly less of an issue. The calendar is more of an issue because, again, events often, we're talking about events that happen in sequence in series. But, you know, for many of them, they're able to look at condensing their season. In the public domain, you'll see that Formula One is looking at double headers, which makes a lot of sense to see if they can get those commitments off by condensing the numbers of races into single venues. That makes a lot of sense. And others, I think, are thinking the same thing. You know, how can we postpone and condense our event commitments into single venues? And that has the benefit, and we're getting used to a new sort of vocabulary, creates a bio bubble or allows you to have all of the athletes and all of the support, event support and logistics in one place at one time, not infecting anybody else. And you can sort of contain the entire event. So most of what's now being discussed around the Bundesliga and the Premier League is taking exactly that principle. How can we condense our play and contain our players with a high level of testing into narrow windows in the same venues?
So in terms of, when you look at the calendar, it's quite an interesting time because obviously people then say, yeah, but we didn't really want to be in this week of the year anyway. We only did it because there was a space. And you sort of start to see that the calendar as it exists is just a series of compromises and you know, there's some bodging going on.
A lot of bodging going on. Yeah.
I guess there's an opportunity for some to say, right, we can get a better spot here.
Yeah, I guess that's probably true, except that everyone's looking at the same better spot. so now we are, and again, we've been doing something which I'm kind of surprised. We'll talk about it in a second. You mentioned whether there's any degree of control and coordination in the industry. And the answer is there is to a degree, but there's not a lot of it. And we'll come back to that. But we've been, because no one else really seems to have been, there are some, but not many, we've been pulling together from public source information and to the extent that our clients and network is happy to disclose it, the best guess we have as to when events are being moved back to. And lo and behold, and no surprise to anybody, probably, everybody is looking at September, the sort of golden month of sport, you could argue. But, you know, we're now looking at between a 50 and 60% increase in events in that month over a normal year. And that feels hard to say that that's a sustainable month of sport, but it just happens to be the first month when I guess people reasonably can say that we might get an event of with some degree of crowd, of live spectator audience. Who knows what that looks like, and we could talk about that in a second. But that September, October seem to be the first 2 months in the year. We're looking at late September, which are outside what we've heard from many of the European countries, and just focusing on Europe for a second, many European countries are saying we will not have events with live spectators before September. Lo and behold, everybody's looking at queuing up events into September. And, you know, whether that's tennis with the French Open, which is postponed from May to September, I think the US Open, again, postponed into September. Then we have US Open Golf. We have the ICC already with its scheduled event in Australia in October. And then I guess you're looking at the major US ball sport leagues and European football leagues all cramming into the Q3, Q4 period of the year. Le Mans, I think, is trying to squeeze into September, and there's already a very busy motorsport season planned now, and that's just got busier. And then even domestically, we know that, you know, some of the motorsport festivals are looking for new dates, and lo and behold, they're settling on September, October. And clearly, excuse me, there are two or three things in play there. It depends whether you pick your economist, but yeah, I think there is a consensus we're going to have a short, sharp recession amongst some and a longer recession amongst others. But the one thing we are absolutely certain about is people's wallets will be bruised as a result of this in terms of the ticket-paying public. Sponsors certainly are looking very carefully at their balance sheets at the moment, and marketing budget is one of the first things to take a trim. And then, of course, broadcasters, ditto. They're looking at their budgets for the remainder of the year and how they can feasibly screen that amount of content in that period of time. So we're looking at a lot of events in a very narrow window, competing for much more constrained dollar. And that's going to be a challenge. Even before, and you and I and everybody else has been talking about this, we're expecting sectorally the sport and entertainment sector to be pretty badly impacted in terms of supply chain. Everybody's hurting from, we are not having the year that we expected. That's for sure. We're okay, but we're not having the year we expected. And there are other agencies in that ecosystem, whether that's hospitality or marketing or production or logistics. And I'm sorry to say it, but it really pains us to say it, but it's true that they may, we may not be looking at the same supply chain come September, October. So the ability to organize and host those events, we think, will be challenged. Because we hope it will be very, very limited, but there may be fewer companies coming back in September, October and able to deliver. So all of that kind of concertinas into a bit of a challenge.
And that consolidation potentially is going to be across rights holders, event holders, but also across agency sector supply. It's a new reality, I guess. My question, if this was a logical world and if sport was logical, and there would be a body, a G20 or something, that oversees this and puts everything into neat sort of packages. There's two questions. Is there anybody that can do that, and is it likely that that body will evolve or appear over the next year?
There is a body that coordinates. We did a piece last week, and I think we were asking, is it time for some sort of, we call it supra body, which not super, although that would be good as well, but supra sits above sport. And of course, you've got the likes of the IOC, who do sit across a number of sports in the Olympic context. But of course, if football or basketball are included in that, the IOC is not responsible for speaking for the NBA and certainly not for FIFA or UEFA. So IOC aside, and they do speak for a number of sports, that no, there is no supra sport body which is coordinating across the sports. And that, I think, has become quite painfully apparent in the course of the last 4 to 8 weeks. And it's not surprising. It's not a criticism. I think sport's been evolving over decades in terms of that finding that equilibrium in the yearly calendar around seasonality, but also just finding times when major events aren't overlapping. So we famously, of course, always had, the odd and even year distinction, which is a very good way of the Olympic Games missing other major championships like the Rugby World Cup final. Within each year, you tend to find, whenever we're working with major rights holders or we're looking at new events, you're asking that question, well, when should we be? Who are we colliding with that week? And that has taken decades to find that sort of equilibrium. And suddenly you have left of field, on comes COVID, and suddenly disrupts all of that equilibrium, throws everything up in the air all at once, and everybody rushes to try and find an alternative date for their events. But they do that all at once in the same months. No one is coordinating.
Do other industries have that sort of body?
Yeah. I think, well, whether you're talking at national level or, dare I say it, in the context of one word, blissfully, we haven't heard too much of recently, Brexit, but at European level, certainly a significant amount of coordination by the European Union across industries, but also things like the British Retail Consortium. There are international trade bodies working within hospitality or travel and tourism they're working with independent bodies, they're working with quasi-government bodies, and those bodies, entities are working on their own account as well, but they are coordinating. So there is a common voice, and they are at least coming together and thinking together. And I think it occurs to us that really is not happening within sport. So to our knowledge, there's no one at a very senior level in Formula One talking at a very senior level with the NBA or the NFL speaking to the ATP or WTA or the IOC in that grouping. And we think there's a space for that, and we're having some conversations about how we might find just a very informal grouping that kind of like your sort of, you know, at British national government level, we have COBRA or SAGE, who come together regularly just to spend a short period of time pulling all of the stakeholders together and just making sure that there is a, you know, a good degree of coordination. And I think that's really what's required. And we are having those conversations informally with clients. And we find ourselves in the position of being interlocutors in that. But actually, we think there's a role for a smaller group of very senior stakeholders covering as many of those big private rights holders and some of the larger international federations, just to make sure there's a degree of coordination to avoid this car crash of a calendar in September, October, where we have, you know, 50 to 60%. I'm just talking about major sports events, 50 to 60% more than normal. That's assuming September, October goes ahead. And of course, I'm no public health expert or virologist, so no idea whether we will indeed be back in a position where we can have sports events even in September. We hope, really hope, pray that we do. But we do think that is lacking. And you see, there's decent coordination within some sports, individual sports, as you'd expect. So UEFA with the national FAs, the conclusion of the leagues and European football and the Euros 2020, now 2021, that looks to be functioning pretty well. Tennis, I have to say, less so. I mean, you look at Roland Garros unilaterally moving because they had to, and they, you know, no niceties there. They've just gone on with it and rescheduled their event to September. It's not just me saying it. You read the players saying that there's a fair degree of dysfunction in the level of organisation between so many quite powerful bodies: ATP, WTA, ITF, LTA, AELTC. So, you know, it kind of reveals where there isn't that coordination even within a sport amongst its key stakeholders. And I think Federer was out this week tweeting to say, isn't it time we had that discussion about merging the ATP and the WTA? And other players have been talking about just the dysfunction of the league and the fact that so many players who don't have endorsements are very exposed on income, where they don't have prize money because they need to play to earn. And you just start to see that those sports, you know, sort of revealing themselves as not as well organised perhaps as they should be. And as I said, we just think above the sports, there is no coordination.
Let's turn the conversation, point it towards your other clients on the city host side, because that's a sort of constituency that I always think that is underrepresented in terms of the conversation. There's a sort of blithe assumption that, okay, the city won't host it in May, but it will in September, or it will in whatever date the rights holder decides. But as we know from, you know, any experience in our local town, that is not always the case. And the cities are going to be under enormous pressure. And I know that in the Euro 2020 or 2021 example, in the football tournament, which obviously the Platini plan was to spread it far and wide. And some of those cities are saying, well, I don't think we can do that next year. We were in for this year and not next year. And I'm sure there'll be, you know, lots of other examples. But just to give us a picture of the view of big sport from that side of the table, because it's one that is quite often not really thought about, certainly not by me.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. It's they are, look, we take a possibly slightly contrary view to the importance of host cities again in this ecosystem. Everyone, I think, focuses, and rightly, you know, they're very, very big investors in terms of broadcast and sponsors, and then gate. But to your point, Richard, I haven't heard too many people in the last few weeks when they're talking about sports events rescheduling in order to hold on to their broadcast and sponsorship revenues. And then we start talking about gate and ticket. I haven't heard too many people talking about the investment from cities. And actually they should be, because cities, we think, are probably the biggest investors in sport. Whether you're talking about the capital investment programs around major sports facilities, which will rank in their billions around a big set piece like FIFA World Cup or the Olympic Games, or increasingly in terms of hosting fees, which are becoming the norm, and rightly, because sport contributes directly into the economies of those cities and regions who are hosting them, with visitation and spend linked to that. So I think cities probably, if they were, you know, if you were to poll them, and as luck would have it, we just have, and we'll be releasing a little bit of research in the course of the next few weeks on that relationship between city and host, that you probably find they feel a little bit taken for granted, because they are such incredibly large investors in sport. So, you know, when we have an argument, which we've seen break out into the open between the IOC and Japan, it's because of the political sensitivity around who picks up the bill. And the reality is both sides picking up very substantial costs in relation to the rescheduling of that event. I would say, given the size of the Japanese economy, their costs probably are insignificant against their however many trillion turnover for GDP as the IOC's costs are. But that is a very sensitive issue. And going back to it, look, we've got the published number of about 12.5 billion invested by the Japanese in the Olympic Games. And, you know, by some estimates, it's probably twice that. And we've found that through previous Olympic Games, that the real investment is probably quite substantially more than the published. But when you stop and pause and you just look at that, that's 12.5 billion published invested in a sport event. I mean, who else does that? No one else invests that sort of level. And it's the same both for Winter Olympic Games, but then the big set piece on the, you know, the FIFA and UEFA events. We are talking billions and billions of pounds worth of investment in major sport. And it's, you know, it seems to us that that's actually fair and proportionate, and government knows that because of the benefits it takes from hosting. Even before you look at the social and public health benefits of those sorts of events, you know, stimulating more physical activity and the public health benefits that flow from that. So we think the investment's fair. It's just not recognised.
I suppose there's a question in terms of whether or not the rights holders are what the return and how the return on investment from the city side is looked at. Because obviously my assumption is always, oh, it's an economic equation of some sort, and that and as we're seeing now, that's real. You know, when it stops, we certainly notice that the economic benefit goes away quite quickly, but that's the sort of front and center of it. Is there anything else? Are the objectives on the city side changing, or are they more nuanced than just, okay, we get, it's a tourism dollar that we're chasing?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's changed over the years, as it has with every other investor in sport, probably bar broadcast, who has always got the economics of it. And, you know, famously, we always talked about sponsorship in the early days being driven by the, I'll say it, chairman, because it was man, now chairman or woman's whim. In the early days of sport, it was about national prestige, and perhaps only that, about the, you know, in terms of the justification and the motivation for hosting major events. It was a big festival, celebration of sport. There was always not a question what the benefit was. And we've seen that morph over 20, 30 years into almost every government we work with recognizing, or at least needing to justify, the investment first and foremost from economic impact. So what is the direct and indirect benefit of all of those participants? In the case of the Olympic Games, 10,000 participants from 28 sports, even before you get to the, you know, their support crews, and then the media and the sponsors and all of their hospitality, and that counts for billions into the economy. And then all the spectators coming for a week, 2 weeks, you know, bodies and beds in hotels, bums and seats in restaurants. So all of that equates to very significant economic impact. And then for other events, different benefits. So if you're a mass participation event, you can draw a very direct line between half marathon, marathon, and 10Ks and sportives coming to town, raising awareness of physical participation in sport. And look, whilst, you know, that may sound fluffy, there was some estimate I read last year that the cost of obesity to the British economy is around 12.5 billion a year. And if you can take even a small bite out of that by encouraging people who are probably a bit overweight to get off a sofa as a result of London Marathon being in town, then probably you can forget all about the needing to quantify economic impact, because that is enough. And increasingly we're finding government is very focused on that, particularly in the Middle East, where they have some of the highest rates of obesity and type 2 diabetes, which is linked to it. They're very, very focused on getting people active, changing the culture around physical activity. And then other sports are around, you know, F1 is about and Formula E to a degree around technology, automotive, sport industry, foreign direct investment, business. So it's very, very layered, and that's why we love it. It's just so layered and complex, and you can really quantify the benefits in all sorts of ways with all sorts of different events. And they all bring a sort of core set of benefits, but some of them are very good at delivering other benefits around social. So we looked at, we worked with FIBA on 3-on-3 some years ago, and that's a fantastic event around social change and enfranchisement in moogas and city centres, short format of the game on half court, really easy to organise. It's kind of dynamite for that. And then we're working with things like the Homeless World Cup at the moment, which is brilliant around giving respect back to homeless people through the playing of football, endorsed by UEFA. Fantastic event. Cause related, really powerful stuff. We think the benefits that cities take from events are layered, and the investment they make in return is huge. And it's just totally, totally underestimated how important that stakeholder is. And I think in recent weeks we've seen some consultation. As I said, I wonder the degree to which hosts and governments are really consulted in the same way as broadcasters and sponsors, and whether that massive investment they make is recognised. I hope it is, but sometimes we feel it's a little bit taken for granted.
Do you think there are politically, a theme of the last sort of few years in terms of the Olympics, for example, trying to get public votes through for city hosting? I wonder if that's been difficult, and I wonder if is that indicative of something? Is it indicative of a general sort of feeling towards big sport, in, for want of a different phrase?
Yeah, I think as I said, where I think sport has perhaps not been as good as it could have been. I think Thomas Bach recognised this with Agenda 2020, and lots of the comms that's happened since. Sport does really contribute. I mean, we've drunk the Kool-Aid on that one. We fully, fully see all of the benefits it brings. But that's in some cases, it's quite subtle what it can do. So often what the public sees is massive investment in capital infrastructure, which it sadly, in some cases, then becomes, as in the case of Brazil with a FIFA World Cup, an open prison or a very large car park for a stadia, which you would assume in that country, given it's football crazy, should have stimulated ongoing use but didn't. And that's kind of what the public sometimes sees, is huge, huge investment in capital infrastructure programs, which just seem disproportionate to the benefit. And I think, actually, the first thing is to make sure that those sports facilities, when built, are proportionate to the event and the benefit that it brings. And also, in and amongst that, that there is good use of temporary infrastructure, good use of existing infrastructure, rather than just building new. And then it's just making sure that what you can do with major events is done with major events through the programs that sit around those events before and after, around all the things I mentioned: social inclusion, public health, participation, engagement of ethnic communities. All of the very layered things you can do need to be done. And then you start to get back to a degree of balance where everyone, because it's well communicated and well seen, accepts that sport is about more than just that sort of 3 weeks worth of competition, which seems to cost billions. It's about a lot more than that. But that, I think that message is lost. And often the implementation of the programs around those major sports events are not as effective as they should be. So it's one thing to measure it. The other thing is to implement it and to do that well. And then I think perhaps public attitudes start to change. But for sure, in the last few years, we both know the industry that sprung up around it looked expensive. The investments looked expensive, and it was sometimes harder to justify those investments when we've been through periods of austerity and hospitals aren't being built, and other major critical capital infrastructure programs seem to be lacking when the government is spending a lot on what looks like a sports jamboree. But to me, that's a matter of making sure the implementation is good around legacy, but then the measurement and the communication of that benefit, and that needs to be done a lot better.
Right. I'm going to ask you a winners and losers question from this period. So I'm just trying to sort of work out who is going to come out of this stronger and who is going to suffer. And if there is anything, any patterns to that, any features of organisations, either on the rights holder side, on the city side, sponsors. Can you see anything in terms of, well, what's going to work? You know, who are the winners and losers out of this?
I think what, yeah, again, we're probably all pretty scared of, and I think it's a reality, is we are going to have a recession. The question is how deep and how long. And I'm going to give you, hopefully not too fluffy an answer, but a bit of a fluffy answer, which is in recessions, proven over time, this bit of a cliche, I'm going to sound like a management consultant now rather than a lawyer like I did at the beginning, but there's a flight to quality. People become a lot more conservative when budgets are constrained and they're looking to justify return on investment. They go to provable, big, you know, bankable major events. And sadly, that impacts the smaller events. So I think we're going to see a period of limited budget, hopefully less so on the public sector side. We set up our business actually in the recession in 2006, and we were continually surprised at how resilient public sector funding was, even through the dark days of Lehman and beyond. And so hopefully public sector budgets, and there will be stimulus and they will invest in major events, but we think it will be a flight to quality. What works? What's provable? And we've seen, and I won't name names, but there are smaller events, a bit more speculative, not quite as, you know, as I said, bankable, a few question marks over there, appeal in market. So I think we'll just see a period of consolidation, and there will be some fallout in terms of some events possibly not, you know, being as successful, and hopefully not the case, but some not making it. Then in terms, you know, in terms of cities, hard to pick, because I think what's unusual about this terrible crisis is it's so fully global. It's hard to see any economy being, you know, more impacted than any other. I hope that's true, because I think it means that the whole, you know, we won't see, I think, when it looks like it will be the whole global economy and every market which is impacted. So in terms of winners and losers, it's hard for me at the moment to think about a region which will come out of this better than others. There are some. We're working a lot with South Korea at the moment, which seems to be, well, feels like almost back to normal. And other Asian countries, I think, have been, you know, have managed the crisis very well. We work with New Zealand a lot, and they've barely felt it in terms of the virus. I'm sure they're feeling it commercially. But I think, you know, the reality is the whole global economy will sink in lockstep rather than it being as normally with recessions. It's, you know, it's pretty regional. I think in this case, it'll be everybody. So I don't know if that's a very clear answer. But I think the theme for me would be flight to quality in the next 12 to 24 months.
Do you think there's a, what about the, on the sponsor side, the, if you are looking, if you're a sort of CMO level, and you're looking at the next 3 years, is there a concern for the sport and event business that actually it looks like a greater risk as an investment? And if all I'm doing is chasing audience of a certain type, and that's why the money is going into sport, then I'll shift it out of sport for a while. Is that a concern that you think, okay, well, I can buy that audience in other ways other than attaching my brand to an event?
It's a really good question. I mean, I think that probably typifies how we felt about brands' approach to rights over the last 5 years, isn't it? The media buying agencies, who always sort of, we always characterize them as being, you know, contrary to our interest in the sponsorship industry, and to a degree that's true, but they've always, over the last 5 years, been able to make that case. Why waste money on rights fees? I can deliver you that audience through programmatic advertising much more cost effectively and cheaply. Question then is, and it has been, and we've, before all of this descended on us, we're feeling a bit more buoyed and optimistic about it, that it really is a question of whether how the public feel about rights and sponsors sponsoring, and are they beginning to feel more positive about real connections between brands and major sports events? And I think we were seeing signs of that, you know, that it was becoming important that brands were properly supporting sports and being, you know, emotionally connected to a sports property rather than using clever programmatic and feeling a little bit ambushy. And also, you know, you and I and everybody else being bombarded with programmatic every time we tune into social media, and actually sport has always offered that cut through. I think, look, I hope the one thing, and
and I hope this hasn't sounded gloomy as an interview, because we're not. We are really positive about the industry's ability to bounce back, and I would say that, but I'd say that in the context of your question on brand. I think that everyone is, I certainly am, I'm sure you are, desperate for sports comeback. And I can't remember whoever said it, but someone said that it's the most important of the unimportant things, or unimportant important thing. I can't remember which way around it was. And I think it's really felt that way. It feels like we, because it's gone, we look at the whole, the shape of the whole that it's left, and realize how important that is, whether it's participation or just distraction, or, you know, all of the, you know, the really nice thing we're all longing for is to have a beer with a mate, or, you know, watching the footy. And I think when it comes back, I hope people will cherish it all the more, and that emotional connection will seem even stronger than it ever does, ever has done in the past. And brands will recognize that. And sort of signs for hope, and perhaps a little bit of a trend, is that sports that recognize what they are, other than kicking a, you know, leather coated bladder around a pitch for 90 minutes, recognize what they bring and can actually offer that to sponsors. So sport becomes more than just about the 90 minutes of distraction, but it's, you know, what it offers to communities and what it does for society are really going to benefit. So the extent to which you as a brand can associate with something that has a massive emotional connection with your consumer, but actually means much more to society. And I'd give a big plug to Homeless World Cup, who we're working for on host city procurement, but also on sponsorship. We are, of all the properties we're working with at the moment, that's the one that is getting a lot of attention, and rightly, because it's the connection with sport, but it's the connection with cause and social related issues. And I think that that's hopefully where we'll see some real uptick and where sport can really perform. But, you know, hopefully, you know, to draw a conclusion to that, we're longing for it to come back. Consumers are longing for it to come back, and brands will always follow the consumer's desire. So I hope that means that they'll be, you know, straight back into the sponsorship market.
Okay, so say all of us. Well, thank you, Angus. That's a good place to end, I think. A note of optimism. It wasn't gloomy at all. If it was, it was my fault for asking gloomy questions, but we'll gloss over that. Okay, so stay well, and thanks very much for your time. Really enjoyed that.
Thanks, Richard. Me too.
Thanks very much for getting this far, listening to the Unofficial Partner podcast. If you like us, please rate us on iTunes. It really helps us get found by other people. And sign up to newsletters and various other activity on unofficialpartner.com.